So last week, we were talking about Lot, and he's one that we know a little bit about, but not a whole lot. Here we go. See? Starting off right. And we got to a point in our study and our discussion last week in which we had a division between Abraham and Lot. What was that division over? I'm going to rephrase that. There's not enough land for the both of us. Right? Same idea. Same concept there. They had too much livestock, too many people. There were some fights among the servants of the cowboys that were there, basically. It's what I normally think of anyway. But they weren't taking care of cows, taking care of sheep and goats. So anyway, they decided they were going to go separate ways. Who was the individual that tried to solve the problem by parting ways? Who was the one that initiated it? Abraham did, right? He was the one the promise was given to in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. He was the one that was told he was going to be the father of many nations, thus the name Abraham. And he was the one that all these blessings were given to because he was God's chosen individual. A lot of time has been spent trying to discern why God chose Abraham. Anyone have a good answer? He ended up, well, not at first, but he ended up being righteous before God, right, at a certain point. The closest answer I've ever actually found, and I think this is about right, is God had to start somewhere. That's the closest I can get to a biblical answer for you. He had to pick someone to bless and to bring this promise of blessing all the nations. And I know this map behind me is somewhat... Yeah, we'll come across a passage that says that God recognizes that Abraham's faithful, and he knows what he's going to do. So yeah, he was a righteous person. He definitely grew that way. The map that we have up on the board behind me, this is obviously as zoomed in as I can get without too much pixelation. The contrast is not ideal for a projector, but hopefully you get the idea. If you look on the right side or the east side of this map of the Dead Sea, you have two locations named Sodom and Gomorrah. These are not modern-day cities any longer. That region is not habitable. It's not farmable. There's not a lot of livestock there. There seems to be a lot of sulfur deposits, ironically, around these two locations, according to archaeology. And the dating of when that sulfur got there seems to be coincidentally around the same time as the early patriarchs. And so we have question marks because we're not too sure exactly where Sodom and Gomorrah, these two large cities, were. These are two good estimates, but I've also seen maps that put it at the north part of the Dead Sea, that put it all the way out towards the Jordan River, so we're not too certain about that. But I wanted to highlight for you that on the right side of this Dead Sea, you have two possible locations for where these cities were. That Lot chose to go towards where it seemed more fertile. That, of course, would be a fertile area because you've got the mountains right there. You've got all the water right there. And then you see on the left-hand side, or the west side, you see Mamre and then Hebron. Those two locations are important because Abraham chooses to go that direction, towards the plains. And that's mentioned specifically in the text that we were in yesterday, or last week, rather. So, I want to kind of give you an idea of what we're looking at here. I often kind of see a map in my head when we talk about a location. I often kind of go there, but I rarely take the time to try and find a great map for you guys to look at, just to kind of get an idea of what this looks like. So, this is where we are. Okay? So, we've left our discussion last week in the idea that Lot lifted up his eyes, Genesis chapter 13. Does that font need to be larger? You can be honest. Yes? Okay. If I hear one yes, I got to do it. If I hear one yes, no. Genesis chapter 13. Is that better? Yes? Okay. I can make it bigger. I can have one letter on one page and then swipe, next letter, next letter, next. You can see it. If Larry got it, can he hear me though?
good.
Did he hear that part? Did you hear my question? Nope. Okay. Genesis 13:10. I'm just kidding, guys. Okay. And Lot lifted up his eyes, saw all the plain of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed this place. And like the garden of the Lord, that the land of Egypt as far as you go towards Zoar. The Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. So we paused there, I believe, last week, because that's a very loaded statement, especially us knowing what we know about the future of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? And we've made a lot of interesting points, and there have been a lot of interesting points about what it means that he pitched his tent even towards Sodom. The idea of pitching his tent, obviously, is a reference to the fact that he was a sojourner. He was not an inhabitant of this land. He didn't have a city. He didn't have a family here. He was just kind of going through these locations, gathering what he needed with his wealth, and that's kind of the idea here. Verse 13, we have a little context for us about why Sodom was mentioned. But the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. So that's important to keep in mind. We wonder if Lot knew that before he went towards that direction. We wonder if after he learned it, if he didn't know before, if that bothered him. We wonder what his relationship to God was like, because we have a lot of information about Abraham and Abram and God, but not a whole lot about Lot and God. So we have a lot of questions that are not answered for us in the text. I think it's interesting, though, to kind of just log this away into our memory, that this is the direction that he chose because it looked like the best decision for him and his family and his household and all his livestock and so on. He went that direction. He went as far as Sodom, and we kind of leave Lot here, and we pick up Lot in two chapters. So here in verse 14, the Lord said to Abram and Lot after Lot had separated from him, "Lift up your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, westward, for all the land which I see I give to you and your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth." And we wonder, because you're going to smash them to pieces and just destroy them all? No. "So that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered." So it's not a reference of them being ground up or destroyed like the dust of the earth, but just being innumerable. So you're going to have one guy who is now called the father of many nations, and he is going to be fathering many nations, right? "Arise, walk the land through its length, its width, for I give it to you." And Abram moved his tent and went and dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and built an altar there to the Lord. What was the altar utilized for?
Worship.
Sacrifice, right? In this patriarchal day, they would have offered animals that God would have been pleased with on these altars as a covering for their sin and faith of God's forgiveness in future times. It's kind of a loaded statement, but that's kind of the reality of what that is. Okay, we go to chapter 14, and we have something entirely different now. We're leaving Abraham for a second, and we're kind of talking about current events, if we live currently in the patriarchal day and age. There were wars going on for a very long time. And it's not wars in the sense of how we often think about warfare today in our modern context. One way to think about this, as far as I'm convinced by my study, is more of a warring tribal situation. These aren't huge numbers of troops moving in unison. They're not moving in a marching order in such a way. We're talking more about raiders kind of happening upon people that are traveling, and then they rob them and leave them half dead, so to speak, and then they continue on. Now we have these giant groups of tribes of people who have leadership, and they're attacking one another. And it just so happens, while all of this is going on with all these different factions and tribes and groups, the guy named Lot gets caught up into it. So it's not as if Lot was responsible for this situation. It's just one of these things that he kind of got himself caught up in. And there definitely is going to be a situation that arises from this that's worthy of mention. Okay? So I do want to read some of this for you. There's a lot of introduction here about who's involved and where they came from and where they went and how they fought. And there's a lot of atlases out there that will tell you exactly where they probably came from and how they maneuvered around ancient Palestine and so on. But I kind of want to skip forward just to the part for our purposes talking about Lot. So in chapter 14, let's skip ahead a little bit, and we'll go on to verse 10. All right. Now the valley of Siddim was full of asphalt pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell there, and the remainder fled to the mountains. We saw the mountain range on the map earlier, right, to the east, that we were talking about here in this context. And then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. So they raided this place, they overthrow these two cities, these two tribes, if you will, and Sodom and Gomorrah fell. They lost this battle. They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. So let's pause here and make the necessary statement. Verse 12, we last saw Lot pitching his tent towards in the direction of Sodom. Where do we find him in this context? Apparently living in Sodom. Now, there's a lot of statements that I've heard. Well, this necessarily means that Lot has given up his faith in God. He went over to the dark side. He changed his ways, and this is what he gets. Well, that's kind of a reach, in my opinion, given what we know about this text. There's like two passages that talk about it. So I understand he must have learned that this was not a holy and just city. And yet, he's living in such a day and age in which if he wants to procure for himself really anything, for his family, for his servants, for his livestock, he's going to have to be friendly with the people that he's living in their land as a stranger. So, personally, I don't necessarily equate finding Lot in Sodom at the time of this attack to be an inference of his spirituality. If you think that is evidence of that, then I have no problem with it. I don't know for sure, but it just seems to me that it would make logical sense to, at least for our purposes in this class, to give him a little benefit of the doubt in this passage, not talking about later. That later is a whole different thing. But at least right here, right now, let's just assume he was just there for trade, he was there because they were a larger city, and then take the text as it is, and we'll make more comments about what we find the next couple of chapters at the appropriate time. Okay, questions, comments, problems with that, anything? Again, it's just an interpretive style. Doesn't mean that I'm kind of saying this is how you must do it. I don't have the right to do that with such little to go on in this text. Okay, verse 13. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew. So now we start to recognize, people are recognizing who this guy is. He's not from around here. He's someone different, but he's someone important, right? For he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorite, a brother of Eshcol, the brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. So you got this guy who's connected. They recognize who Abram is. They know Lot has been taken. And they go to Abram, and they say, look, you're at this location where we left you the last chapter, so to speak. They got your brother, and they got your nephew. Verse 14. Now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house and went in pursuit as far as Dan. All right. Now, this is one of the coolest statements to me, because if you know me at all, you know I kind of visualize things in kind of a unique, maybe slightly twisted way for my own entertainment. I can just imagine this old guy, Abram, hearing his nephew was taken by the kings of the north. And his reaction is to do what? All right, boys, load up. We're going to go get him. And he gets his 318, that's just the coolest statement, 318 trained servants, fighting men that were born in his house, men that he grew up with, taken care of, and so on, arms them, and they go out to get him. That's just cool. I'm a nerd. Verse 15. He divided his forces against them by night. Pretty good tactic. And he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. So a pretty good bit. They weren't just hiking across the, you know, the street here to go get Lot. They had to actually go, and they had to have provisions, and they had to get there in a very interesting way. And Abraham was wise enough to use his tactics, to use his small force to be able to accomplish what he wanted to do. So very, very interesting to know that even in an ancient day and age, all these things about warfare were known, and they were used by a guy who wasn't a soldier, just a guy who was probably just a shepherd. Verse 16. So he brought back all the goods. So he beat the raiders at their own game, and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. So got all their stuff, they got all their people, got the objective, everybody's good to go. Verse 17, and the king of Sodom, the guy who lost, right, went out to meet him in the valley of Sheba, which is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of this guy, and the kings who were with him. That's such a long name, I tried really hard to say it for you guys correctly, but I can't do it. It just sounds wrong. So verse 18, and then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of the God Most High. Almost out of nowhere, we got this new character introduced to us who is of a pivotal role for us as Christians. And we ask the question, why? Because there's an entire section in the book of Hebrews in which this conversation gives us evidence that Jesus is more important than Abraham. I know it kind of sounds interconnected and not connected at all, but there's a very important thing that happens here in the next context. Verse 19, and he, talking about Melchizedek, blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he, talking about Abram, gave him a tithe of all. Interesting note. And we wonder why in the world that's mentioned for us. We don't learn until a couple hundred years later. Verse 21. Now the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons and take the goods for yourself. So we have the king of Sodom introduced. He goes to meet him. He just happens to come upon Melchizedek. This guy's a priest of our God. And then Abram gives him a tithe. What is the meaning of a tithe? A tenth is literally what it means. So he gives him a tenth of all the goods that he brought back from this victory. He gave to Melchizedek, which is an interesting note for the book of Hebrews, right? And then the king of Sodom comes forward and says, hey, look, you won that battle that I lost. I appreciate you. Why don't you keep all the spoils and just give me all the people back? That seems like a really fair thing for a guy that really could have said, you know what, all that's mine, let's fight about it. You only got 318 if you didn't lose anybody, probably less than that. I can take it all for myself. Verse 22, but Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand to the Lord God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, and that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. Only, verse 24, except what the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men who went with me, Aner, Eskol, and Mamre, let them take their portion. So he goes, king of Sodom, I got a deal for you. You say I can take all the spoils, you just want your people back? Well, you can have it all back. I don't want a single thing from you. The only thing that we actually took from you is provisions to get from point A to point B back home. Got everybody and everything back, except for these guys that fought with me who brought me that news that my nephew was taken by these raiders, by these kings of the north. Why do you think that he did this? Well, he told us why, but why do you think he felt like he had to say to this guy, I don't want a single thing from you, lest you say you made me rich? Why was that even there for us? Mm-hmm. Okay, so he knew this guy. What else? Like, well, is that a good decision that he made or a bad decision? What did Abraham owe the king of Sodom? Nothing. And he wanted to keep it that way. He didn't want to be in his debt. He didn't want to have a favor to call in one day. He didn't want him to think of himself too high, like he owned Abram because he allowed him to take all those goods from that battle that he won of his own volition. He was an independent contractor, and he was going to stay that way, right? Abram was not involved in the warfare business, and he didn't want to be. And so that little tactical decision that we see of him not aligning himself with the powerful, evil kings of his day and age, it's a very interesting decision that he made. It would have been safer, I think, in a logistical fashion to say, you know what, I can use some good friends just in case. If I got a powerful friend, the king of Sodom, who wants to be on my side and we can work together to get things accomplished, that's a good decision. But instead what he's doing is walking away from that alliance with this powerful king, wealthy king, and he's just relying on God to provide what he needs. It's an interesting decision. If all those things are true, and we're correct about assuming all those things of his mindset, then he is launching out in faith, trusting in God to give him what he needs, as he's been proven true thus far. Okay, questions, comments, different thoughts? Yeah. Good question. I don't know. Can we turn the ringer off on the iPhone? Just flip that little switch on the left-hand side to turn that ringer down for me. Appreciate that. Yeah. Well, I don't know. He said to the king of Salem, to the king of Sodom, you know, I didn't take anything except for what we ate. So I don't know. Interesting note there. I don't have an answer for you. Yeah. Okay. Go. Oh. Right. Right. For those that don't know, in the book of Hebrews, the point is made to Jewish people who are Christians who are thinking about leaving Christianity. He's saying, you guys think that Abraham is your forefather, you trust in him, and you want to go back to him as your guide? That's all well and good, but you have to recognize that Jesus is better because he's a priest, right? Not a high priest like Aaron. He's a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. So he is a high priest that supersedes the law of Moses. And the Hebrews writer makes the point. He says, Abram, who is the father of the Jewish nation, he gave 10% to a greater person than he, Melchizedek, who is a priest of God Most High. So you got the entire nation of Israel, right, kind of in the loins, if you pardon the expression, of Abram, giving respect to a priest after the order of Melchizedek, who Jesus really is. So really, the Jews gave tithes and respect to Jesus in a way. So that was the application that was made by the Hebrews writer. Larry?
One observation I often will say, and I imagine a lot of us do, that God did not only deal with Abraham,
yeah,
but other people.
Yeah. We sometimes, especially from the context of just looking at the verses that we have, just looking at the books that have been preserved for us, that are inspired, we have little boxes. And we want to put God in those little boxes. And we forget that he's the God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. He didn't just deal with Abram, this patriarchal period. We have another book written by another patriarch that we don't know a whole lot about, named Job. And he offered animal sacrifices for himself and his entire family, his children included. Now, how did he know to offer those animal sacrifices? Well, he learned from his daddy. and he learned from his daddy, and he learned from his daddy. And it was just passed down through the patriarch of the family to the next generation. And so there are these little cells, these little groups of people that descended from the same guy, right? Adam and then Noah, in which they have this information about who God really is. And they're not tainted by idolatry quite yet. It's a different world before the law of Moses really is introduced. Okay? So good note there. So, focusing on Lot again, we're standing back away from the text and kind of getting a vision of where we see him. He had enough faith originally to leave his family, leave his father's house, leave a known city where his daddy dwelt or his uncle dwelt, and then left with Abram to go to a country where they didn't know they were going, right? That took an enormous amount of faith to be able to trust Abraham, who trusted God in the first place, right? And then we see them getting wealthy after a big famine when they went down to Egypt. God blessed them like he said they would, Lot included. And then they got so blessed, so wealthy from their livestock and so on, they had to part ways. So you got Lot going to the east, Abram going to the right. Lot going to the east wasn't a good move because there was a war going on and he got caught up in it. And so he was taken away as a captive. Abram came in, swooped in, saved his nephew, saved the day, and made some decisions that would align him not with the kings that are powerful, but with God himself, the King of Kings. And so that's where we find ourselves here at this particular junction. Okay, questions, comments, additions? That's kind of a big view of what we've done so far. Let's move forward through verse 15. This is talking about Abram. He's an important guy, but he's not the focus of our attention for this particular session. We move forward to chapter 18. Chapter 18, it does deal with Abram again, because he's kind of the main focus for good reason. But there are some things that are revealed to us at the beginning of chapter 18 that deal with Lot very soon that we want to cover. Otherwise, we're having to kind of give you a brief overview. I really don't want to do that. I want to give you all the text that I've had to be able to introduce this topic to you. Okay, so chapter 18, let's begin reading in verse 1. And then the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre, as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. I've read that purposefully, very slowly for me, to be able to emphasize a few things. Number one, it was hot, right? That shouldn't be a surprise to you. Desert climate is hot in the middle of the day. So where is he going to be on a daily basis in the middle of the day?
In the shade.
That's where you want to be, right? They don't have AC yet. They don't know what Freon is. They don't know what a compressor is or a fan blower or any of that stuff. So they're having to kind of use what they've got, which is maybe 10 degrees less than what they get in the sun, okay? The Lord appeared to him at that location where he dwelled. Interesting that it's said that way. Because later, in the next chapter, we're going to be talking about two angels that go to Sodom and Gomorrah. So it's different than just an angel appearing to someone at this particular location. Whenever it says the Lord appeared, it's an interesting time for us to pay attention to what's going on, right? And the reason why we do that is because we made the application at the site of the burning bush, right? When Moses was out as a shepherd, the Lord appeared to him and spoke from the midst of a burning bush that was not consumed. It easily could have said an angel, a messenger, appeared to him, but it says the Lord appeared to him. And the point has been driven home. It's very possible, even likely, that when we see these instances in which the Lord appears, we're actually witnessing a time of who we would call Jesus, the second person of the Godhead, before he took up a body, doing something in the Old Testament. And if that's true, it's very interesting for where we find ourselves in this context. Very interesting to me to see what that is. If it actually is just an angel, not a big deal. If it actually is Jesus, again, not a huge deal, but it's more interesting to the text, right? So, verse 2. So, talking about Abram, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold. You got to love the Hebrew style of writing. He just said the same thing three different ways to emphasize how important this moment is, right? And Jesus sat down, opened his mouth, and began speaking to them, saying. Three things, same meaning, to emphasize what's about to happen is significant. Okay. He looked, and behold, three men were standing by him, and he saw them. He ran from the tent door to meet them. He bowed himself to the ground and said, "My Lord, if I have now found favor in your sight, do not pass on by your servant." Let's pause right there. Do you think he greeted every guest that just happened across his camp this way? I don't think so. That'd be mighty inconvenient. I've got people that walk by my door all the time. Can you imagine if every time somebody walked by my door at my house, I'd kick open the door, run out to them, drop to my knees, prostrate, and say, "Please, don't keep going. Stop in here." No, of course not. So we're trying to emphasize here something special is happening, and Abraham's aware of it, right? It's not normal behavior. I've heard that before. This is just what he normally did. That can't be, I don't think. Verse 4, "Please, let a little water be brought, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree." Says, "Hey, look, you going this direction? Stop in here. I'll get you some water. I'll clean you up. You get some shade, and then you can go on your way." Why do you think he was so cordial? Well, it was the heat of the day. He was resting himself. It's not a time for travel. It's a time for rest. And so he's offering it to these people that are walking. How many are present at this particular appearance? Three. Important to know. That's why you got three-point sermons, because there are three people here. It's a joke. Okay. "And I will bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh your hearts. And after that, you may pass by, inasmuch as you have come to your servant." So just like you appeared, you can be on your way. Let me help you out. Please don't keep going. I got some water. Wash your feet. Take some shade. Take some food. And then you can be on your way. Please stop. They said, "Do as you have said." This is so cool. So Abram hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, "Quickly, make ready 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, make cakes." So I love this because I can just imagine him running in all excited. You know, he's kind of an older guy, and she's kind of an older lady. He says, "Hurry up, make some food." She goes, "Okay, I'll make some food." All right, verse 7. "And Abram ran to the herd, took a tender and good calf, gave it to a young man, and hastened to prepare it." So he's like, "All right, you make some bread, I'll get some meat, don't even worry about it." He took some butter and milk and the calf which he had prepared and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree as they ate. So here we have a lot of people lose their minds. Are angels eating people food? Do angels have to eat human food? How's all that work? I don't know. I know on other occasions when they tried to offer food to angels, they just took it and put it on a rock and offered it to God as a sacrifice to prove this guy's an angel. Apparently, Abram already knew that, so I don't know. "And they said to him, 'Where is Sarah, your wife?'" As if they didn't already know where Sarah, his wife, already was, right? They brought bread. So he said, "Here in the tent." And he said, "I will certainly return to you according to the time of life." If you take that to its fullest extent, that can drive you crazy. This is Abram, who did what God told him to do. He was in the Ur of Chaldees. He went to the land of his brother Haran. He left Haran with his nephew Lot. He went to a land where he didn't know he was going. He tried to protect himself, but ultimately, eventually, finally learned that God was going to protect him because of that promise. And now he's trusting in God, and he's waiting for years and years to have a son who's the promised son that God promised three different times so he can finally be the father of many nations that God told him all those years before. And then Sarah's in there. She's the one who's going to bear the promised son, the father of many nations coming from Abraham, but also, of course, through Sarah. And an angel who here seems to be the second person of the Godhead before he's in the incarnate word says, "I'm going to come back when it's the right time." The right time? When is that going to be? We have been waiting and waiting and waiting. We did everything that you wanted, and we're still waiting. So you're going to come back, huh? When the time is right. Okay. So I say it all that way so dramatically because sometimes in our minds, when we pray for something, we think we need something, we think we want something, and we get so desperate, we just forget that we're not in control. Things are not set by our scale of time, right? I will certainly return to you according to the time of life, and behold, Sarah your wife shall have a son. One of my favorite passages. And Sarah was listening in the tent door. Of course she was. There are three angels outside. She just made them bread, which was behind him. Now Abram and Sarah were old, well advanced in age. Very polite way to say it. And Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. So the natural order of things when it came from her to actually bear a child biologically would not happen. She could not conceive through normal means. And therefore, because she's like, look, I'm too old. It's not going to happen. I'm way past the age of childbearing. She laughed within herself. What's that mean?
Chuckled, I guess.
I guess she chuckled. To me, it kind of gives the indication that she didn't do it audibly.
Smirked.
She smirked? I wouldn't know anything about that. I never smirk. I can just imagine Abram being out front, hearing that, and then maybe not, but maybe hearing, from the tent behind him, and they go, what was that? Can we just laugh at that? Anyway. And therefore, Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord, being old also? Like, really? We're too old. And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh, saying, surely I will bear a child since I am old? So they just immediately, second person of the Godhead, possibly, says to Abraham, why'd you laugh at that? What's so funny back there? I told you, God, that's why you left, right? Is anything too hard for the Lord? Great question. Great question. Let's chase a rabbit. Okay, ready? Is anything too hard for the Lord? We say no, because we know it, theoretically, until something really hard comes our way. And then sometimes we doubt. And that's normal. That's natural. A lot of people do it. That little reminder that possibly Jesus, before he's Jesus, just asked Sarah, is anything too hard for the Lord? Remember, the Lord never asks questions for information. He already knows the answer, right? When he asked, where's Sarah? Oh, in the tent behind me. Okay, good. She'll want to hear this. I know she's listening. She's going to bear a child. Huh? Why'd she laugh? Well, I didn't laugh. What do you mean? I believe you. Sure. So anyway, the point driving home verse 14 is the fact that sometimes when hard stuff gets sent our way, it's a good reminder. But although we may have doubts, we may have fear, a lot of folks did. And nothing is too hard for the Lord. Okay. At the appointed time, whenever that is, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. And Sarah denied it, saying, I didn't laugh. Why? Because she was afraid. Interesting how she was afraid that she would never have a son, and now she's afraid of the Lord thinking she's never going to have a son. He said, no, but she laughed. I really would love to know Jesus personally and well enough to know how his reactions were. We don't get a lot of that in Scripture, probably for a good reason, because it doesn't really translate well. Imagine me trying to explain to a person 1,000 years from now the emotion of me rolling my eyes. It could be me having a seizure. It could be me just exhausted and I'm so tired, my eyes rolled back in my head. It's hard to explain these nuances that come with our vernacular. So I don't know how, no, but you did laugh, exclamation mark, which is not there in the Hebrew, by the way, is meant. I wonder if he just kind of tried to calm her down because she was really afraid of what was going to happen, if she doubted the Lord, or if he was just saying, you know what, you left. I know you did. Anyway. Isn't it? Oh, man. I didn't do that. No, the thing that's going to get me in trouble, I didn't do it. Really. I love watching funny videos. Usually it's of people doing dumb stuff they never should have thought of to do, and then they get hurt doing it. I don't know why I find it so funny. But the second favorite funny videos for me to watch are kids who did something bad. And they're like, no, it wasn't me. You see lipstick all over a mirror in a little 2 or 3 year old's drawing all over it with the lipstick tube in the dude's hand, the little kid's hand. And the mom comes in with the camera and he's just like, did you draw on the mirror? No, this is going to fit right in so well. And the answer he gave to who it actually was blew my mind. He goes, no, it wasn't me. It was Batman. Batman broke in and did this while he's holding the lipstick tube. Like, only a kid, right? Anyway, I wonder if it was like that. The Lord's like, no, you laughed. Batman's coming?
Yeah.
Oh, the Lord?
Yeah.
What? Oh, no. Maddie will never do anything like that. So y'all think you got to figure it out. Oh, just wait until she becomes a teenager. You guys don't know my trick. She's never going to grow up. I'm the only man she ever needs in her life. She's never going to go to college or move away or have none of that. She's just going to stay a little baby. Nice and sweet, toothless grin forever. That's my secret. Yeah. Okay, we're going to pause here for the morning. We're out of time. I did want to stop before verse 15, ironically, so we're going to talk about how Abraham tries to bargain with God for the sake of all the people. And maybe that has a parallel of somebody else who would want to have a proposition before the Lord about saving some righteous people. I don't know. Maybe not. So we'll pause here this morning. Thank you for your attention. We'll pick up a little more about Lot next week. Okay.